You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today, it's pretty laser focused. We're taking the cardiac action potential, you know, that really complex bit of electrophysiology, and making it directly useful, like something you can use confidently right there at the bedside for rapid decisions.
Exactly. Because let's be honest, the AP often feels a bit abstract, doesn't it? Something you cram for exams.
Right.
But it's actually the heart's electrical blueprint. Think of it maybe like a stadium wave. It's this incredibly precise sequence of ion channels opening, closing, rising, and falling.
Coordinated wave.
Perfectly coordinated. And if something messes up that choreography, maybe an anesthetic agent, maybe an electrolyte shift, the rhythm breaks down, that's when you get chaos, arrhythmias.
Okay, so let's really dig into the relevance right away. Why should we, as anesthesiologists, get bogged down in the molecular details, the ions moving across membranes?
Well, because we are often the ones changing things. First off, our drugs fundamentally alter that choreography.
Propofol volatiles.
Yep, propofol volatiles, even local anesthetics, they all directly mess with sodium, calcium, potassium channels, NaV1.5, CaV1.2, K plus channels. They're all targets.
Okay, point one, drugs.
Point two, electrolytes are the fuel. Simple things, common things we see all the time, like hypo or hyperkalemia, shifts in magnesium, calcium, they critically distort the AP timing, especially when the heart's already under stress.
And that leads to the third point, right? The high-risk patients.
Absolutely. Someone with congenital long QT or maybe acute ischemia, severe heart failure, their underlying issues just magnify every little change we introduce. So understanding the molecules isn't just academic. It's literally the safety margin for that patient.
Got it. So let's use that framework you mentioned. Molecular mechanism, NASI ECG, metaseizure relevance, phase by phase.
Sounds good. Let's start at the beginning. Phase zero, the rapid depolarization. The upstroke.
That huge, fast spike.
That's the one. It's driven by this massive, rapid influx of sodium ions through the NaV1.5 channels and on the ECG. That translates directly to the QRS complex. It's the biggest electrical signal.
And clinically, this is where local anesthetics really exert their effect, isn't it?
Exactly. They block these NaV1.5 channels, slowing down that conduction. What's really fascinating, though, is the frequency-dependent blockade.
Meaning, the faster the heart beats, the worse the block gets.
Precisely. The channels open and close more frequently at higher heart rates, so the drug binds more effectively. It explains why tachycardia can worsen local anesthetic toxicity.
Okay, so the pearl is using something like lidocaine, which has faster kinetics, to suppress ventricular ectopy, say, after an MI.
Right. But the pitfall, the really scary one, is bupivacaine toxicity, last local anesthetic systemic toxicity.
Because bupivacaine just clamps onto those NaV1.5 channels and doesn't let go easily.
It binds with incredibly high affinity and dissociates very slowly. So it doesn't just slow conduction, it can cause complete refractory cardiac arrest.
Which is why the immediate life-saving maneuver isn't just standard ACLS, it's
lipid emulsion therapy. Got to give intralipid right away.
Why does that work again?
The lipid acts like a sink. Bupivacaine is highly lipid soluble, so the emulsion effectively pulls the drug out of the cardiac tissue, off the channels, hopefully restoring that phase zero depolarization.
Okay, crucial stuff. Let's move on. Phase one, that little initial repolarization dip.
Yeah, it's brief. A transient outward current, mainly potassium, the Edo current, maybe a bit of chloride influx too. It causes that little notch you sometimes see right after the QRS at the very beginning of the ST segment.
Doesn't seem like much, but you said it sets the stage.
It does. It helps set the membrane potential for the really critical phase that follows the plateau. And it's quite sensitive to potassium levels.
Ah, so low potassium starts causing problems even here.
It can. Altered phase one repolarization, especially with hypokalemia, can contribute to conditions favoring re-entry arrhythmias.
So the clinical takeaway is be proactive with potassium replacement.
Definitely. Keeping potassium in a good range, say above 4.0, perioperatively really does seem to lower the risk of arrhythmias. But the pitfall is being too aggressive.
Trying to correct it too fast.
Exactly. Rapid 4 potassium infusion can be dangerous, potentially provoking VFib itself because the heart just can't handle that sudden ionic shift safely, slow and steady.
Right. Okay, now the big one. Phase 2. The plateau. The power stroke, as you called it.
Yeah, this is where the contraction really happens. It's this delicate balance. You've got calcium ions flowing in through the L-type channels, the CaV1.2 channels.
Sustained influx.
Right, sustained. And that influx is basically balanced by potassium ions flowing out. This equilibrium holds the membrane potential relatively constant for a period. That's the plateau, the ST segment on the ECG.
And if calcium influx drives contraction, this phase must be hugely impacted by our anesthetics. I think many people still think propofol's main cardiac hit is vasodilation. How important is that direct calcium channel effect?
In the patient with heart failure, it's paramount. It's absolutely critical. Yes, vasodilation happens, but the direct negative inotropy from blocking those phase two calcium channels, that's what can cause catastrophic hypotension in someone with a really poor ejection fraction.
So volatiles, propofol, even high-dose magnesium, they all dampen this phase.
They all dampen CAV 1.2 influx to some degree. We're not just managing afterload. We're directly modulating the power source of the contraction itself.
Is there any upside? I've heard theories about volatile preconditioning.
Yeah, there's some interesting research suggesting, for example, sevoflurane might offer some myocardial protection, possibly through subtle effects on these channels, making the heart more resilient to ischemia. It's complex.
But the clear danger zone is something like propofol infusion syndrome, pre-offs.
Absolutely. Preese involves profound cardiac depression, and a big part of that is severely impaired mitochondrial function, but also major disruption of calcium handling, directly impacting phase two. That explains the profound cardiac failure you can see.
Okay, phase two handled. Let's move to the wind down. Phase three, repolarization, getting back to baseline.
This is all about getting the cell ready to fire again. It's primarily driven by potassium ions flowing out of the cell through several types of channels, notably the delayed rectifier channels, IKR and IKs.
IKR, that involves the ATRG channel, right? The one implicated in drug-induced long QT.
That's the one. Hugely important. This potassium efflux brings the membrane potential back down toward resting levels. Clinically, this whole process shapes the T wave on the ECG. And the duration of phase three fundamentally determines the QT interval.
And this is where so many drugs we use come into play.
Oh, absolutely. Sevoflurane prolongs it. Ondansetron, our go-to antiemetic, prolongs it. Methadone, if the patient's on it.
Zofran is a big one people forget.
It really is. And the danger is amplified. It becomes this perfect storm if the patient also has low potassium or low magnesium.
Why is that?
Because those electrolytes are crucial for the proper function of these potassium channels. Low K plus or low Mg plus plus makes the channel sluggish, prolongs phase three even more, makes the heart vulnerable to those dangerous early after depolarizations.
Which can trigger torsades the point.
Exactly. That polymorphic VT.
The clinical pearl here seems obvious but critical. Magnesium.
Give IV magnesium for torsades. It works because Mg++ helps stabilize and facilitate the function of that IKR-ERG channel, helping to shorten phase 3 repolarization and stop the arrhythmia.
And the pitfall.
Missing subtle hypomagnesemia. If the Mg level is low, correcting potassium alone might not be enough, and the torsades might persist. Always think Mg++ out.
Okay, brings us home. Phase 4, resting membrane potential.
This is the quiet phase, electrically speaking. The cell is back at its negative resting potential, around Natish 90 millivolts. The key player here is the sodium-potassium ATPase pump.
The NAS plus K plus pump.
Right. It's actively pumping 3 sodium ions out for every 2 potassium ions it pumps in, restoring those ionic gradients that were run down during the action potential. This maintains the negative resting potential and keeps the cell ready for the next beat. On the ECG, this is the isoelectric baseline between beats.
And the classic drug interaction here involves digoxin.
Correct. Digoxin specifically inhibits this NAM plus K plus ATPase pump.
So what does that do electrophysiologically?
Well, if the pump is blocked, sodium starts to build up inside the cell. This increased intracellular sodium then affects another exchanger, the sodium-calcium exchanger, causing it to work in reverse, bringing more calcium into the cell.
Ah, so it leads to intracellular calcium overload.
Exactly. And that calcium overload is what causes the characteristic problems of digoxin toxicity delayed after depolarizations, leading to ventricular ectopy, bradyarrhythmias.
Which explains the infamous stone heart warning. Why is giving calcium to a patient with digoxin toxicity potentially lethal?
Because the root problem in DIG toxicity is already too much intracellular calcium due to the inhibited Na plus K plus pump. If you then give more calcium intravenously, you just flood the cell completely. The sarcoplasmic reticulum gets overwhelmed, can't sequester at all, and you can get this sustained irreversible contraction.
Fixing the ECG number, but potentially causing irreversible muscle damage. Grim.
It really highlights how understanding the underlying ionic mechanism, even in phase four, is crucial for safe treatment.
Okay, that phase-by-phase breakdown is incredibly helpful. Now let's try to synthesize this. How can we map this onto things we use daily, like drug classes? The Vaughan Williams classification seems relevant here.
It maps surprisingly well, actually. It's a functional map. Class I drugs are your sodium channel blockers. They hit phase zero, lidocaine, bupivacaine, etc.
Got it. Phase zero blockers.
Class II are the beta blockers. They primarily work by reducing the slope of phase four depolarization in pacemaker cells, slowing heart rate, but also have some indirect effects.
Okay, phase four influence mostly.
Class III drugs are the potassium channel blockers, think amiodarone, sotalol. They prolong phase three, lengthen the QT interval, high risk for torsades with these.
Phase three targets, high risk.
And class IV are the calcium channel blockers, verapamil, diltiazem. They primarily depress phase two, that plateau phase, reducing contractility and slowing AV node conduction.
Phase two blockers. So knowing the drug class tells you where in the action potential it's working.
Exactly. And that helps you predict interactions or avoid dangerous combinations.
But as you said earlier, sometimes it's not the drug we give, but the patient's underlying fuel, the electrolytes. Let's tackle the big two emergency imbalances. Hyperkalemia first.
Right. High potassium. Electrically, it does two main things. It slows down phase zero depolarization because it makes the resting membrane potential less negative, partially inactivating sodium channels, and it tends to shorten phase three repolarization.
So on the ECG, you see?
The classic signs. Peaked T waves first, then PR prolongation, widening of the QRAS complex, loss of P waves, and eventually potentially a systole or sine wave pattern.
Yeah.
Very dangerous.
Okay, K is 6.8, QRS is wide. What's the absolute first step? People might think insulin glucose to shift the K plus N.
Nope. First step always is calcium gluconate 5-HT or calcium chloride if you have central access.
Why calcium before shifting?
Because the immediate life threat is the electrical instability caused by the effect of high K plus on the phase zero sodium channels. Calcium directly antagonizes this effect at the membrane level. It stabilizes the membrane potential now, buying you time. Doesn't lower the potassium level, but it protects the heart electrically.
Membrane stabilization first, then shift the K plus set.
Then you give insulin and glucose, maybe sodium bicarbonate, maybe beta agonists like salbutamol, things to drive the potassium back into the cells and lower the serum level, and eventually removal via dialysis or diuretics if needed.
Got it. Now the opposite problem, hypokalemia.
Low potassium. This is primarily a phase three problem. It impairs the function of those outward potassium currents, particularly IKR.
So it prolongs repolarization.
Right. Prolongs phase three, leading to QT prolongation on the ECG. You might also see ST depression, flattening of the T wave, and the appearance of U waves.
And the big risk here is?
Torsades to points. That prolonged repolarization sets the stage for early after depolarizations.
Exactly.
Slow intravenous potassium chloride replacement. Slowly, and crucially, check and replete magnesium at the same time.
Why the magnesium light?
Magnesium is essential for proper potassium handling, both for the channels themselves and for renal retention via the ROMK channel in the kidney. If magnesium is low, the kidney just wastes potassium and you'll struggle to correct the hypokalemia effectively. They go hand in hand.
Treat them together. Okay, before we hit some cases, quick monitoring pearls in the OR related to this.
Yeah, two quick ones. First, know the danger threshold for QT interval. If you see the corrected QT, the QTC, creeping above 500 milliseconds intraoperatively, that's a major red flag.
What do you do?
Stop any potentially offending drugs if possible, especially volatiles, Sofren. Check electrolyte stat, particularly K+ and Mg+++. Treat any deficiencies. Be ready for torsades.
And the second pearl.
Be cautious interpreting ST changes with volatile anesthetics. Sevoflurane in particular can sometimes cause subtle ST segment depression or T wave changes simply due to its effects on phase three repolarization, not necessarily due to ischemia.
So don't jump straight to ischemia if the hemodynamics are stable.
Exactly. You must correlate it with the whole clinical picture. Hemodynamics, wall motion on TE if you have it, patient risk factors, context is everything. Don't chase purely electrical changes without clinical correlation. Oh, and one more. Never, ever rely on the BIS monitor for cardiac rhythm assessment.
Right. BIS is brainwaves, not heart electricity. Seems obvious, but worth stating.
Definitely.
Okay, let's put this all together. Rapid fire clinical scenarios. Focus on the why based on the AP. Case, action, rationale. Case one, induction for a patient with severe heart failure, EF maybe 25%. You need to induce anesthesia.
Okay. Analysis. This patient's heart muscle is weak. Their contractility is heavily reliant on every bit of calcium influx they can get during phase two. They have minimal cardiac reserve.
Action.
Avoid a large bolus of propofol. It's a potent depressant of phase 2 calcium entry. Prefer etomidate or maybe ketamine, as they tend to maintain or even support contractility better.
Rationale.
You need to protect that fragile phase 2 power stroke. Directly inhibiting it with propofol could easily lead to profound, perhaps irreversible hypotension and circulatory collapse.
Makes sense. Case 2. Patient coming for surgery has known congenital long QT syndrome.
Analysis. Okay, their baseline physiology involves delayed phase 3 repolarization due to a genetic defect, usually in one of the potassium channels like IK or EERG. They are exquisitely sensitive to any drug that further prolongs phase 3. Strict avoidance of all known QT prolonging drugs. That means no sevoflurane, probably no desflurane, no ondansetron, use dexamethasone, or maybe droperidol cautiously if needed for PONV. Consider propofol Tiva and be absolutely meticulous about electrolytes. Keep potassium high normal, maybe above 4.5, and magnesium above 2.0. Have defibrillator pads on.
Rationale.
Minimize any further delay in phase 3. Maximize the efficiency of the repolarization they do have by ensuring optimal electrolyte levels for the potassium channels. Reduce the risk of RNT phenomenon leading to torsades.
Okay. Case 3. You've just done a large volume peripheral nerve block with bupivacaine. Suddenly the patient becomes bradycardic, hypotensive, then maybe seizes or loses consciousness.
Analysis. This screams alast bupivacaine cardiotoxicity. The high plasma level is causing profound blockade of cardiac sodium channels of phase 0 catastrophe. Conduction is failing.
Action. Immediate.
Lipid emulsion therapy. 20% intralipid, 1.5 milliligram bolus over a minute, then start an infusion. Call for help, manage airway, start CPR if needed, following ACLS, but with modifications.
What modifications?
Key thing is to avoid large doses of epinephrine if possible, or use smaller boluses, example 1 millisie GTG. High-dose epi can worsen myocardial toxicity and impair resuscitation in the last, possibly due to increased heart rate enhancing the frequency-dependent block. Amiodarone might be preferred for VTVF.
Rationale for the lipid.
The lipid sink theory. Pull the lipophilic bupivacaine out of the heart tissue and bind it within the plasma lipid phase, allowing the sodium channels to recover.
Got it. Case 4. Intraoperative labs come back. Potassium is 6.5 milloEQL. ECG shows widening QRS.
Analysis. Acute severe hyperkalemia. The high potassium is slowing phase 0 conduction, hence the wide QRS. Immediate risk of further conduction block, bradycardia, or asystole.
Action. First step.
IV calcium gluconate, 10 millimolar of 10% solution over 2 to 5 minutes. Stat.
Rationale.
Membrane stabilization. Antagonize the effect of potassium on the sodium channel threshold potential. Buys you time before you start shifting the potassium with insulin glucose, bicarb, or albuterol. Stabilize first. Shift second. And obviously stop any potassium-containing fluids and avoid sectional choline.
Final case. Case 5. Suddenly, during maintenance with sevoflurane, the monitor shows torsades de pointes, polymorphic VT, twisting axis.
Analysis. Likely triggered by a combination of factors prolonging phase 3 repolarization. The sevoflurane is a likely contributor, possibly combined with underlying electrolyte issues like low magnesium or low potassium or other QT prolonging drugs.
Action. First drug.
Stop the sevoflurane, immediately switch to Tiva or just oxygen if possible, and give IV magnesium sulfate, 2 grams bolus over 1 to 2 minutes.
Not defibrillation first.
You might need to defibrillate if they lose pulses, but the underlying cause is the prolonged repolarization. Magnesium directly addresses this by facilitating IKR function, shortening phase 3, and suppressing the early after depolarizations. Defibrillation alone often fails if the electrophysiologic substrate isn't corrected. Check and treat K-plus levels too.
Wow. Okay, so in every single one of those critical scenarios, understanding the specific phase of the action potential affected gives you the direct rationale for the life-saving intervention.
Exactly. It connects the dots from the ion channel behavior phase 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, to the ECG changes, to the drug effects, to the right emergency action. It's the bridge from basic science to truly safe and effective clinical practice.
That really drives home the mission we started with. Using this layered framework molecule, ECG drug case, turns what feels like abstract physiology into a powerful tool for confident, rapid decision-making right when it matters most. It's about seeing the action potential, not just as physics on a diagram, but hearing it as the language your patient's heart is using to speak to you, especially under anesthesia. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.